Well, let's, before we exhaust ourselves, let's talk about a girl of 40. It seems that in your novel, Frank Curtis has returned.
Ah, you notice.
With, of course, in some of your earlier stories, Frank had different spelling for Curtis.
Right. But still something of the same man, only a bit older. He's not quite consistent with the early stories. I once asked Elmore Leonard why he changed the names from one book to the next, although it's clearly the same one. He said, because when you sell the movie rights, you sell the right to that character, so he uses a different name in each book, in almost every book. That wasn't the case. He's a bit of an alter ego of a certain aspect, I guess, of my feeling and experience.
Yeah, I could sense a Herbert Gold in Frank Curtis.
But it's not Herbert Gold, because Frank, for example, has no children. I have five. Frank is a slightly failed professor of journalism. I consider myself a fairly successful novelist and journalist. He's a gloomy wasp. I am a cheerful Jew. There are a lot of differences.
Of course, in one of the stories, I can't remember the title, in which Frank Curtis had an affair with a student, and the student blows the whistle, and for some reason which is inexplicable to me, but apparently it was aimed at drawing him to her and leaving the wife, I guess. I mean, I wasn't really sure how she would do something as stupid as that, but she did it. But here the wife tosses him out, the bags out inside and all of that. So there was, and you had recounted earlier, I don't want to go into a lot of personal details, but you had recounted earlier some bitterness with previous marital problems. So in that respect, perhaps there may be some similarities.
Well, it's written, as to why she did that, it's written in granite that if someone is having an affair with a married person and wants the married person to leave the spouse, that person will arrange for the spouse to know about it in the hope that that will speed the marriage to its end.
Well, it did that. Now, in A Girl of 40, Suki. Suki is also making a reappearance.
It's a different Suki. It's not the same.
Suki with a strange name.
Well, a lot of Susies and Suzannes are called Suki. It's a name I like. But this is a different Suki. I don't think I've ever had this 40-year-old girl in anything I've written before, nor when she was younger did I ever write about her. I really she's been conceived out of the last 25 years of my life in San Francisco.
Well, A Girl of 40 is as much about A Girl of 40, namely Suki, as it is about Suki's son, Peter. This is a very touching novel that you've written. I have a son who's just turned 18, and while he is not like Peter at all, there are still similarities, because adolescence is a period that all parents should be allowed to skip. It's really a tough time for both parents and children. As I read A Girl of 40, and I saw Peter's... It is Peter.
Peter, that's right.
His outrageous behavior. Outrageous. I wanted to reach over and just slap him, you know, slap him this way and then that way. And, of course, Frank Curtis does take a swing at him at one point, and I was happy about it. I didn't realize, however, that this boy was so disturbed that that there would be an ending as tragically as that developed. But tell me a little bit about how you conceived the idea for this arrangement of Frank and Suki and Peter, and just give me a little background about
this. Like most of my books, this one began with a meeting between a man and a woman, and I first thought I was just writing a short story about a kind of morose middle-aged man who meets a very sexy and charming girl of 40. Then, as I started to think about what her life might be like, it was obvious that she might have had another marriage and might have a child. I have adolescent children myself now. And whatever problems there are, try to imagine the problems there would be if your son or daughter, I have both sons and daughters, had no father. And so I saw Frank getting involved with Suki being the kind of free spirit, the other word for that would be promiscuous, person that she is, what does that do to her son, who witnesses the parade of men in and out of their breakfast nook in the morning? And then I thought about Frank's feeling about Suki, a kind of warmth or generosity that he would have, a kind of connection he'd have with the boy. And then if you just look around San Francisco, or just look at any newspaper in any city, you see the lost kids that are floating around, with some of them with money, some of them without, cast out in borderless families, families without limits. So the story grew that way.
Why did Peter, who had seen Suki's various men friends come and go, hone in so directly on Frank Curtis, especially when Frank Curtis had befriended him in the past? Why was Frank Curtis selected out of all these men?
One thing was that because of the dynamics between Frank and Suki, Frank really determined to remain her friend, remain connected to her. It was not just an affair for him. It was a kind of friendship. Well, it was a kind of love is what it amounted to. And so therefore, he kept the connection. A lot of men, the men going in and out of a promiscuous woman's life, aren't going to care about the sun they might see in the shower in the morning at all. It's just that Frank was different, so he related to the boy. And exactly as any adolescent will strike out at the one he loves most, you know, each man kills the thing he loves. It's particularly true of adolescent kids. Whom do they hate most? Their mothers and their fathers, at the same time as those are the people they love most. And so Peter relates to him. And Frank, maybe because he didn't have a family of his own, was accepting of that, was willing to put up with it up to a point. And once their hooks were in each other, then you have trouble ahead.
You have an interesting character in the police officer. I couldn't tell if that was really, if he really spoke the street language or jive talk or whatever they call it now, or just naturally, or if this was
I love intent. That. I like that character. In a way, sometimes I wake up and I think he's the only one in the book that I really like, but I like them all. But Alfonso is based on a New York City police officer that I knew in Haiti 30 years ago. And what this man would do, which is what I made Alfonso do, is he's educated and can speak perfect English, but he plays games. He does jive talk to make fun of himself. In a way, he's an Uncle Tom who plays against being an Uncle Tom by pretending to be an Uncle Tom and pretending to be a street character. And he's, in a way, he's bilingual, as I am, you know, as anybody who's comes from any special ethnic society has English. We're all, actually, Americans are all bilingual, because we have English, maybe, if we've been educated, and we also have American. And a black American has American and English and probably black speech also. But it's an aspect of Alfonso's humor that he does that. He falls in and out of that.
You have two party scenes. Well, one is really awake, I guess, but you introduce a lot of very interesting characters. You must hit the party scene in San Francisco to peg people the way you did, because there seemed to be, of course, I've never been in San Francisco, so I don't know, but there seemed to be a legitimacy there.
There is a great deal of white wine and brie life in San Francisco, and I don't do that so much, but you know, writers are sponges. You have an experience once, and it ramifies out. I've been to parties, who hasn't? But I think any writer anyone who's been in love can imagine every possibility of love. And anyone who's been to a party can imagine all kinds of different parties. The people those people, the woman, the feminist woman who has a tavern in North Beach, and the hip talking Hollywood movie writer, and the gay Iranian, and so on. These are people like people that you could meet, I think, on the east side of Manhattan, or in the Hamptons, or in Coral Gables, or on the near north side of Chicago, or in Westwood, or in San Francisco.
As you wrote A Girl of 40, did you know how the story was going to end?
No. No, I find it hard to write a book, almost impossible to write a book if I know how it's going to come out, because I lose interest. It's like falling in love and knowing exactly what's going to happen next. You lose interest. Or even, you brought up a party. A good party is not one where everything is going to be on schedule. At 11 o'clock you play spin the tail on the donkey. At 12 o'clock
spin the bottle.
You spin the bottle is what I was thinking of.
It was when I was seven.
Right. So that's a wasteful way of working. With A Girl of 40, I think it came out. But I've stopped writing books because I got to a certain point and I didn't know what was going to happen next and couldn't find what was going to happen next. So I have a couple of 150-page, 170-page unfinished novels. This one came out.
It sure did. Why did you decide to end the book so violently?
I think actually
you don't have to give a reason. I mean, you're the writer,
well,
and the writers don't
actually
have to have reasons for everything.
The exact end is not violent. The end is I think an even bigger surprise. You mean, I know what you're referring to. I tried to see where Peter could come out, and it seemed to me that he was just supremely, sublimely self-destructive. And in fact, many adolescents do threaten their own lives. And it just seemed like what he would do next. But the book doesn't end with that. The book ends with what comes after.
Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing. It's been 2 years since we talked. You had the book about the veteran journalist, Mr. White Eyes. Are you still teaching?
Not teaching. I just finished doing a piece for Playboy about Haiti. I spent a couple of weeks in Haiti, which is an extraordinary and fascinating and tragic place now. And I saw a man cut up and thrown on a fire, and I interviewed some of
the... How did you have that proximity to this horrible event?
Actually, he wasn't killed when I was... He was killed before I got there, but I went to the town of Gonaïves, which is where the revolution in Haiti began, and there's still a lot of trouble going on there. And it just happened, this man was a malfaiteur, an evildoer. He was a loup-garou, which means a werewolf. And so he was killed by the people. Approximately 100 people were involved in his killing, and with a bugle, with a trumpet blowing, a kind of voodoo murder, ritual murder. They didn't cut him up out of cruelty, out of bloodlust, but because he was a werewolf, they had to do that, otherwise he could put himself back together. In other words, they were trying to prevent his coming back after he was dead.
My God, what a primitive
It's a strange place.
Is this article that you've written to give the idea of what Haiti is like now in the aftermath?
Exactly. You're a good... a couple of times you've anticipated what was in my head. Yeah, it's the assignment was to do Haiti after Duvalier. Mm-hmm. Haiti after Baby Doc. It's going to be, I think, in the December issue.
It seems to me that a couple of years ago you told me you were going to... Oh, you were about to leave on a vacation somewhere, and I think the day I got the note...
Martinique? Mauritius?
There was a revolt, a revolution, a coup or something. If that was the same country you were going to, and I thought...
May have been. Was it Haiti?
I can't remember. It wasn't Haiti.
I
can't remember the country, and maybe I was off on it. But
I went to the Seychelles do a magazine piece. Maybe. The coup happened right after I left.
That may have been it. That may have been it. But I was pretty sure, as I look back, it's been a couple of years, but you were either about to go, or there was some transition there. I don't
it's
know exactly
strange
what
if
your,
you do...
Your schedule, but there was a some sort of coup or revolt in this area that you were going to, I think, if I had that correct.
Well, I'm a peaceful, four-eyed, middle-aged novelist, and yet I found myself now, and I guess this happens if you live long enough, in five different wars or revolutions. I counted them the other day. In fact, I wrote a new introduction to a reissue of an early novel of mine called The Man Who Was Not With It. And I discovered that although I think I live in a book-lined room, actually I'm involved in a lot of wars. as you recall, Mr. White Eyes, it's about a man who's covered 17 wars or revolutions. That's more than I have. But if you wander the world now, it's not a peaceful place, and you're likely to stumble into such things. And places that tend to be interesting also tend to be unstable.
Well, San Francisco and New York aren't exactly peaceful places either. I'm stunned a little bit as I walk the streets of New York by the aura of violence that seems to be there. I don't know. I don't think it's my imagination.
I've seen. I put my head down as I was walking up West 43rd Street a couple years ago and just missed getting a face full of fist. There was a man walking through the crowd. It was lunch hour, with his arm outstretched and his fist clenched, and anybody who didn't see him coming was just going to get a fist in a face. I lived in San Francisco through what's called the Flower Revolution, which was quite a bit different. But there was a lot of violence during that. I was in Berkeley when the National Guard was throwing tear gas, and there was a lot of violence. America's a violent place.
Well, that's a different kind of violence. That is a socially motivated violence or politically motivated violence. But I mean just casual violence, irate people killing other people or attacking other people, arguments. I'll take the subway down to work, and I will see somebody trying to push on a train, and somebody objects. And there are words exchanged, and this doesn't happen every day. I mean, the majority of the time, everything is all right, but occasionally this happens, and I find myself waiting for it. I was walking down the street the other day to go to a meeting, and apparently a man bumped a woman on the sidewalk, and she said something, and they began yelling and at each other, but she walked off, and then the man screamed at her. And she turned around and said, "Not you." And he ran after her. And all of a sudden, I saw him hitting her on the sidewalk. And a whole bunch of people ran over, I guess, and separated. Mm-hmm. But just to be attacked, I mean, there was an exchange of words, but to attack a woman.
In New York once, a man pulled into a parking space that I was waiting to back into. And I got out and went up to him and said, "You took my parking place." And he looked up at me and said, "Man, I ain't rational." And I realized if I said one more word, he was going to pull out a knife, a gun, a hatchet, or something.
This happened to me. I'll tell you what happened to me. I wanted to stop off at the liquor store. And so I began to back into a space by a fire hydrant. Now, there was a car at the far end of that space, and I wasn't even near him, but he kept hitting his horn. But I backed in, and I think I gave him the finger, something like that, you know, This guy gets out of his car, and he runs over to my car, and he begins pounding on my windows. No, actually, he pulled up. He got his car started to move up. And then he slammed on his brakes, and he backed up, and he got out of the car, and he began banging on the car, screaming and shouting. I had the door locked, but I was stunned.
Yeah, this
I was shocked. He was a middle-aged man, and apparently his wife was in there. Yeah. What happened if he had attacked me in my car, and I had a gun, and I wasn't rational?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a big man. He probably would have killed me. He was so angry, but angry because he got the finger? I mean, that doesn't make sense to physically attack a car, does it?
But human beings don't make sense. They'll do almost anything you can imagine. I once had a man. I was, again, a quarrel over a parking space. I was with my two sons, and a man gets out of the car, comes toward me with a baseball bat. And I didn't know what I was driving a convertible. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had my two twin sons in the car with me. And true panic, he stopped and he said, "If you didn't have those kids, I'd fracture your skull," something like that, and walked away. And he was, I think, and it was near a club. He was wearing shorts. I think he was probably an upper middle class or a wealthy San Francisco citizen.
There is an emotionality about parking in places like San Francisco and New York. That's true. And there's a feeling of terror. I've seen people, the people who drive little cars like Volkswagens, and you're driving a big one, and you're backing in, and they can go in front ways. I mean, this is used to happen to me a lot, and I never liked that very much.
I saw a man in Greenwich Village the last time I was in New York pounding, trying to break a car, trying to smash it. and screaming. And he seemed really insane. And I discovered that it was his own car. He'd locked his keys in. I didn't know you could do that, I guess.
Well, let's turn to violence, to talking about you and your relationship to San Francisco, which looks like it's developed quite a literary community. I've interviewed a lot of people. I did an interview recently with Anne Rice, the vampire lady.
Yes, she was a student of mine years ago.
Is that right?
When I was teaching.
Oh, she's cute. And, see, I've done Alice Adams twice, and I did a man who probably is not well known, but he's written a thriller. His name is, I believe, Robert Byrne, a novel about a skyscraper that topples over. Strangely, he set the scene in New York rather than San Francisco. And gosh, there have been several other...
There must be 250 convicted book writers in the San Francisco Bay Area, at least, if you count poets, more. I know a lot of writers, but there are a whole lot of writers I don't know. At the same time, you use the word community. There isn't really a literary community. There's nothing to bring them together. There's no Don Swain. There are a few publishers, but you don't have that whole literary scene of agents, publishers, review media, and so on. So I have a lot of friends among writers. Not a lot. Some, but I see them because they are friends. There's no real way of bringing them together.
There's no Elaine's.
There is a cafe called Enrico's, but it really isn't like Elaine's.
Have you ever been to Elaine's?
I've been to Elaine's twice, I think. Mm-hmm. And both times I saw famous coke-using writers sitting at the bar. I went once with someone fairly well-known. We got a good table, and I went once with someone unwell-known, and we didn't get a good table.
Well, Elaine's is located across from my, or catty corner from my former apartment building. But I swore that I would never enter Elaine's unless I am taken by Woody Allen. And Woody Allen has not bothered to offer to take me, so I have steadfastly refused to go. There's a wonderful scene, you might recall it was in a book called the movie version of a book called The Diary of a Mad Housewife. It had Richard Benjamin and Carrie Snodgrass. And I believe that's the title. And he wants to go to Elaine's, and they go to Elaine's, and the two of them sit at a lousy table. The waiters ignore them. They're looking around for well-known people. They're very preppy types anyway. They live in Central Park West, and she's desperately unhappy because I think both are having affairs and things are not going well. Did you read the book?
I didn't.
So it's not bad. But the movie version, I can't remember the scene in the book, but I do remember the scene in the at Elaine's, and they just struck me as so pathetic, sitting there, and I think you almost have to know somebody there to really fit in. I mean, anybody can go in and order spaghetti.
I have a feeling these things. I don't know whether Elaine's still has what it once had, but New York and every stylish literary milieu has its cafes, which are the one of the time. In my various times in New York and visits to New York, I could count the White Horse Tavern, the San Remo, which doesn't exist anymore, the Ginger Man, Casey's in the Village,
the Lion's
and that's right, and the Cedar Bar,
Cedar,
and Elaine's, and they all had their period, and then after they're dead, they still function for tourism and as part of the mythology. But I suspect. I'm sure there was a time when working writers went to Elaine's to exchange shop talk. Now I think it's a tourist mecca, don't you?
I think so. I was at a party for Kaylee Jones, James Jones' daughter, a while back, and George Plimpton was there, and Bill and Rose Styron were there, and Rose Styron said, "Oh, come on, everybody, we're going up to Elaine's." Well, I said, "Not me. I'm waiting for Woody Allen." So I haven't been there yet. I was down at the Cedar Tavern. You know Malcolm Bossie? You know, wrote a stuff. He wrote The Warlord.
Yeah, I know his name. I don't know.
He's really a good writer, and he teaches at CCNY. But he hangs out down at the
Cedar Tavern. Used to be a hangout for the then well known abstract expressionist painters. And since I had more fun with painters than with writers in those days, I used to go there. But then there were writers who like me, preferred to play softball in the park with painters and with writers.
What's it going to be like when you leave San Francisco and come back to New York to do teaching in the fall? Looking forward to that?
I'm looking forward to spending a few months in New York. It's time for me to revisit the scenes of my youth, my extreme youth. I went to school in New York. And to me, it's like visiting an exotic other country to come back to New York. I've been in San Francisco a quarter of a century now. That makes me a native son of the Golden West. So I feel as if I should be wearing leather boots and a fringe jacket and be called Lucky or Slim or Tex when I come back to Manhattan. I don't know what it's going to be like. That's why I'm doing it.
Oh, where are you going to stay? Have you figured out a spot yet?
Where am I going to stay? I'm hoping to get an apartment. I have various possibilities, one on West 11th and one on Washington Square North, both of which would be really good.
Like sublets or something?
Sublets.
So expensive. I could not, if I didn't have a stabilized apartment on the west side, I would be living here.
I have a friend who's hoping to spend some time in San Francisco, and if we can work it out, we'll exchange apartments. I'll live in his in the village, and he'll have mine in San Francisco.
Back to San Francisco and your writing habits. You told me the last time we did an interview that you have this insatiable urge and need to write. I assume this is still the case. Do you find yourself working every day? How do you set your schedule up?
My own understanding of myself is that I work 24 hours a day, which means a lot of the time I'm not doing anything. I'm really writing. I don't anymore have a schedule of certain number of hours at work. I try to think in the morning before the head gets filled with hot air from the bill collectors and all the various obligations of life. My real ideal is to get up at dawn and write before anybody gets up to have breakfast, and when the air is clean and the soul is pure. And generally, when I'm with a girl of 40, for example, and it got going and it felt good, I really wanted to do that more than anything, and I wrote every day. Not everything I wrote every day was worth keeping, but the thing marched along like a continuous dream.
What do you do when you're not writing?
When I'm not writing, I play racquetball. I do journalism, which I consider a different kind. It's not the same as this kind of writing. I enjoy my children. I walk.
They all live in San Francisco?
All my five children live in San Francisco, which means I'm pretty lucky.
What? How old is the oldest?
I have kids of every age you can imagine, starting from the oldest is 35, and then I have one who's 33, and then I have one who's 17, and then I have two who are 15.
15?
Two who are 15.
Lucky you.
Well, they're wonderful. I have twin sons who are really a joy, and I know it's immoral to enjoy 15-year-olds,
yes,
but I really do.
Or 16 or 17 years, or my just turned 18 yesterday.
I keep asking them when they're going to start being pains in the butt, and they won't give me a date yet.
They don't live with you, though.
They live with their mother, but it's only they live a five-minute walk from where I live, so they really go back and forth between her house and mine, it's an easy relation. I mean, in a way, it's the best possible means to divorce, to have children, to have a good relation with the ex-wife, and to have the kids nearby.
Well, Herbert Gold, you have two books out, hardcover books out this year, Lovers and Cohorts. This book, your short story collection, and some of these are from other short story collections that you've had, but there are no fresh stories. I was looking.
There are some.
Are there?
There are a couple. There are one or two stories. Christmas in Dakar, I think, was never been printed before. And one or two others, I think.
But there was nothing to indicate when the stories were originally published or where.
I deliberately left that out because I didn't want the reading of the stories to be distorted by the sense that this was written 25 years ago. And I didn't want people to say, oh, this story was in Hudson Review, therefore it's serious, and this story was in Playboy, therefore it's not. So it was that was a deliberate choice.
How is ownership established with these stories when they are sold to a magazine?
The law is, the rules have changed now, but basically what a magazine buys is the right to use it once. And with it, and then by the time the magazine, as I understand it, by the time the magazine is off the stands, you have the right to do anything else you want with it.
What about the magazine? Can it do something with it?
No. Usually they buy, in fact, the formal term is First American Serial Rights. In other words, usually what the magazine buys, let's say it's the New Yorker, it buys the right to print the story once and that's it. Often they'll add to use it once in the magazine and in an anthology of, let's say, stories from the New Yorker.
You are so prolific as a writer. How do you keep track of everything you've written? How did you remember to... where these stories were and what you wanted to use?
I keep a notebook in which I write down where a story has appeared. Sometimes I forget what year it appeared. With some of these stories, by the way, I rewrote them slightly before they went in the book. I discovered that with some of the earlier stories, I did things, mostly it involved cutting, that I didn't think are necessary now. When I first started writing, I guess I read a lot of psychology and I wanted to explain why people did what they did. Now I don't think you need to explain. If the events are crucial and clear enough, you don't need to say why.
Also, your interpretation may change, which tends to happen.
It's better to let the reader interpret from a real experience expressed.
Well, so you have the short story collection, Lovers and Cohorts, and of course your new novel, which is wonderful. It's one of the best things you've written. I like it. I even like it better than Mr. White Eyes, which is a book that I liked a lot, especially because it dealt with a journalist. But I thought A Girl of 40 was masterfully done. I mean that. It was a book that I think I read in two sittings, and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I hope it takes off for you and becomes another Father's.
Thank you.
Herbert Gold, as usual, it was nice talking to you, and I appreciate very much that you took the time to come in and talk to me.
Thank you much.